first order of business is the approval of the Quality Improvement and Patient Protection Minutes for March 23rd, 2016.
So moved.
Any discussion or correction? Hearing none, all those in favor? Okay, now we move to the next set of minutes. I'll turn it over to Dr.
The second issue is approval of the CPMP minutes from February 24th meeting.
Move, yes, second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Anyone in opposition? Okay, the minutes are approved.
So this morning we're going to do a sort of listening session. This is not an official public hearing, but really an opportunity for the commission to get feedback information about the issue of, out-of-network billing. If you'd like to offer comments today, please be sure to sign up. There was a sign-up sheet on the way into the meeting, just outside the door. If you previously notified the HBC staff that you wanted to provide comments, you should already be on the list. We will call up an individual or a panel of speakers to the table here in front to provide public to provide comments. Please keep your comments relatively brief, less than 5 minutes, so we have time for everyone wishing to provide comments to do so this morning. The commissioners and the HBC staff may have questions, which we will try to hold until you finish speaking. And time permitting, we will ask if there's anyone else in attendance who would like to provide comments at the end. We certainly also welcome written comments. So if you're unable to speak today or you have some thoughts following the meeting, certainly you can provide those to the staff at HPC. Do we have a brief?
I am going to provide a data update, and I think I can provide it pretty quickly. There is a slide to go with this. In short, Chia and we are working together on a variety of things that were identified in the cost trends report. The ones that I particularly want to mention is that we are working together on provider efficiency measures of various sorts, and we are also working together on provider-to-provider discount counts and drug rebates within what the law permits. The final thing that I'll just mention, and I don't think we want to say too much about it now, but Lois can correct me if otherwise, is that we and Chia are aware of the Supreme Court's Gobay decision, although we are still struggling to be sure we know the official pronunciation for the decision. But that, is raising questions not only about the All Payer Claims database, but also about other important data sources that come from providers and, from payers, but have historically been based on a comprehensive set of claims.
Okay. On the issue of the out-of-network billing, I would also call your attention to the policy brief that was put out by the staff. If you haven't seen it, I know it's on the website, and I think copies are available. So, want to give a summary of that policy brief?
Sure. Did they go? I think they go. Okay. Great. Good morning. I'm Kate McCann. I'm associate counsel here. And for the benefit of both commissioners and the members of the public today, first we just wanted to give a brief refresher on the lead up to today's meeting so that everyone's on the same page. As you'll recall, in the HPC's recent cost trends report, there was a broad recommendation regarding enhancements to out-of-network billing protections. And in response to great commissioner interest, HPC staff presented on out-of-network billing in more detail at the last commission meeting on March 2nd. And prepared and released, as Commissioner Cohen said, a policy brief on out-of-network billing. In connection with the brief, today's meeting is an effort to gather additional information from stakeholders and members of the public about their viewpoints on this topic and reactions to the brief. We are particularly interested in learning more about the extent of these issues in Massachusetts from an on-the-ground perspective, so to speak, and the different stakeholder perspectives. So the next two slides, I'll just briefly summarize some of the key points from the brief. Please see the brief for additional details. To frame the conversation appropriately, there are many reasons why patients may receive care from providers that are not in the provider network for their particular insurance plan. In the brief and the surrounding conversations, including today's session, we're talking about situations where patients do not or cannot intentionally choose to receive care, out of network. So this can happen in emergency settings for obvious reasons. It also can happen in circumstances where a patient elects affirmatively to go to an in-network facility, but while they're there, they receive care from an out-of-network provider. So these types of out-of-network care scenarios can result in balance billing or surprise billing. For everyone's sake, just a quick refresher, balance billing is where a patient is billed for the difference between an insurer's payment and the provider's charges for the services provided. And a surprise bill is where a patient unexpectedly receives a bill from an out-of-network provider after having sought care at an in-network facility. Massachusetts has already undertaken certain protections in this space, as discussed more fully in the brief. With respect to emergency care, insurers must pay a reasonable amount for out-of-network emergency services, but balance billing isn't clearly or explicitly prohibited in many situations, and balance billing may occur. Insurers may elect sometimes at their discretion to hold their members harmless, so holding members to their cost-sharing levels, even when insurers are not required to do that, and we understand at least anecdotally that sometimes insurers do this. In terms of out-of-network care at an in-network facility, Massachusetts insurers are required to cover services with no greater cost-sharing to the patient if the patient didn't have a reasonable opportunity to choose to get that care from an in-network provider at that facility. But there is no current standardized insurer approach to resolving these types of out-of-network billing concerns, and patients may have to be affirmatively aware of their rights in order to resolve and contest any bills and surprise bills here. And lastly on this slide, important to note that comprehensive data regarding these issues are difficult to both obtain and quantify, and that goes for Massachusetts-specific data as well. The HPC understands, at least anecdotally, that balance billing for emergency services and surprise billing may occur in Massachusetts, but we continue to seek additional information in this space regarding the extent and nature of these issues. And that's a big part of why we're here today. So as I mentioned, there are laws in place currently that seek to address these issues. Nevertheless, there are some concerns that may need to be further addressed. For example, lack of patient notice and potential financial and administrative burden for patients may continue to pose difficulties for patients. There also may be implications for the healthcare market as a whole. For instance, the absence of balance billing prohibitions and limits on out-of-network charges for emergency services may affect provider-insurer negotiations and could potentially impact overall spending. As described in much greater detail in the brief, several states have taken a variety of approaches to address these issues. They vary in multiple respects. New York's law is commonly thought to be the most comprehensive to date. It incorporates provisions from the three sort of primary policy realms in this area, which are disclosure and transparency, kind of upfront, upstream, trying to help patients prevent these types of situations, hold harmless provisions, and balance billing prohibitions, which really aim to remove the patient from the payment equation in the event they receive out-of-network care of this type. And then finally, solutions around determination of provider payment for the out-of-network provider, and there are a variety of mechanisms that can be addressed. As mentioned earlier in the cost trends report and reiterated in the brief, the HBC has made broad recommendations around enhancements to these protections, That includes a recommendation that the legislature set a maximum reasonable price for out-of-network services so that there are not direct or indirect increases in spending or any other unintended consequences as a result of policy solutions in this space. So that's a very high-level summary of the brief. As we said, there's much more additional detail in the brief. Be happy to pause for questions before we turn it back over to Commissioner Cohen to lead us through the comment period of the meeting. Okay, Commissioner Cohen.
Kate, thank you. Very good summary. Our first commenter today is Michael Calder from Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts.
The dubious honor of being first. It doesn't happen very often. Two teenagers at home, so I appreciate that. Chairs Cutler, Cohen, Commissioners Everett, Lord, Allen, Master Giovanni, Turner, Moore, Director Seltz. That's the hard part of the testimony. Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts appreciates the opportunity to offer comments as the Health Policy Commission considers approaches to address the pressing issues about out-of-network costs and billing. Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts has extensive experience dealing with this problem, and we applaud the HPC's consideration of needed solutions through this joint meeting of the Committees on Cost Trends and Market Performance and the Quality Improvement and Patient Protection Committee. This is, simply put, a critical issue. Massachusetts needs to implement additional safeguards on the receipt of out-of-network care and out-of-network billing for two critical reasons, so that we can better protect patients and we can better control costs. There are three critical elements, each essential to ensuring an effective plan. A, there needs to be consumer guidance on surprise billing scenarios. B, there needs to be stronger protections so that patients are protected from being balance billed in specific scenarios. And C, the state should establish maximum reasonable provider reimbursements for out-of-network services. All three issues must be tackled in a composite fashion. Otherwise, without any of the component parts, negative consumer and cost effects will occur. I'll start with consumer awareness. Blue Cross, on its own part, let me do a little bit of education on our practices. Blue Cross, Blue Shield of Massachusetts, on our own part, works hard to educate our members. Our member service team ensures that they are aware of the benefits and risks of out-of-network usage. We educate patients, our members, through a wide variety of communications, including benefit material, explanation of benefits forms, and other vehicles. We are proud of our leading work, for example, in the explanation of benefits field, with our recent work being illustrated at the Division of Insurance as a market example of plain English consumer summaries, so people can very bluntly and factually see what their exposure is for out-of-network costs, in-network costs, the reimbursement of the services, and what their own financial exposure may be in a given scenario. While we continue to work to ensure that our members can access a robust and high-quality network of providers to minimize care outside of the network, no network is all-inclusive. In any scenario, in any setting across the country, leakage does result in added cost to consumers in the system at large. In many instances where there is this out-of-network usage, Blue Cross will hold the member harmless for the cost of care, and then use this additional opportunity, leverage that opportunity to further educate them on out-of-network usage. But we feel that it's unfair to hold the member at harm for the risk of going out-of-network when they may not know about the situation or it's simply a surprise, similar to the concepts of the HPC report on this issue, which I think really illustrates the main features. Additionally, Blue Cross's innovative payment models have established a platform where our primary care physicians are engaged in direct patients to seek care from value-based providers, including the usage of in-network providers. So there's a natural gelling of the network through our AQC and our expansion of that through PPO, so that doctors and patients have financial benefits from seeing in-network usage, and so that has a natural gelling impact on the strength of network protections. As an example, we regularly share reports and data with our provider organizations in the AQC on the services their patients receive. We identify opportunities to redirect care in instances where a patient may be at risk for seeing an out-of-network provider, particularly where there are patterns of care occurring in a particular network situation where folks are being directed out-of-network, many times inadvertently, by providers. Blue Cross would further support working with the HPC and other policymakers on further recommendations for additional consumer protections. For example, Massachusetts may wish to consider a recent New York law on insured member protections that sets forth very specific surprise bill and non-surprise bill situations, including the reminder that a patient is not surprise billed when they choose, with foreknowledge, to receive services from a non-participating doctor instead of an available participating doctor. I think the New York statute on point is really well drafted. It was a result of a consensus set of work. New York is not known as an insurer-friendly regulator, so I think I want to illustrate that to you for the fact that they've adopted a proposal that I think protects the member, but also works in terms of the marketplace and expectations. The second element that I want to stress is the need for balanced billing protections. Effective balanced billing protections, prohibitions, have to protect patients. While Blue Cross already goes to great lengths to shield our members from balanced billing, there needs to be a standard prohibition against balanced billing set out in statute, or at least in guidance from the Division of Insurance, coupled with an appropriate payment rate to truly address this problem. While the HPC has focused on emergent situations, many times out-of-network issues often also exist in non-emergent scenarios. As the next generation of innovation occurs in value-based plan designs, we talked about that last week at our HPC forum, including further development of increased tools around limited and tiered products, out-of-network usage and increased costs will continue to be a problem, both at a member level and at a system level. It's a complicated area. It requires detailed study. In particular, Massachusetts should consider and discuss specific scenarios, detailed scenarios, when effective balance billing protections may already exist by statute or could be furthered. In its consideration, the HPC should analyze the effect of existing law in the marketplace, including relevant sections of Mass General Law, Chapter 176G, and provisions of the ACA governing emergency situations on reimbursement. The reason why I don't go into any more detail on that is I think it's a fact-specific inquiry, and I think it will require additional work back and forth between a variety of stakeholders. But suffice to say that we think that there should be further extensions of balance billing protections. The last element, and I list it last not in terms of any lack of importance, because it is central to the effectiveness of any procedures and improvements in this field, is the establishment of an effective but also reasonable out-of-network payment rate. Establishing an out-of-network payment rate would address many of the cost considerations for payers, patients, and the Commonwealth itself as both the payer and monitor of healthcare costs system-wide. For Blue Cross Blue Shield alone, Massachusetts out-of-network services totaled over $134 million in 2015, the last available data. This cost to the system could be dramatically decreased if an equitable rate is set for these services. And I want to be clear about that system cost. It doesn't get dedicated in one particular area. It gets diffused across the marketplace like any other system cost. In many cases, our employers or individual consumers are bearing the brunt of that cost through an extension of those costs into premium. So it's a direct issue. It's deserving of that cost. In terms of premium impact, if you were to look at that $134 million sort of back of the envelope estimates is that that's almost 8-9 percent points in premium that could be taken out of the system. In setting a maximum reasonable price for out-of-network services, the Health Policy Commission should adhere to several key principles. First, the overall impact should result in cost savings to consumers and have minimal additional administrative expenses, not just to payers, but also to providers. There should be a reasonable, transparent, and simple approach to applying a rate. Lastly, any rate should ensure that current network participation levels are at minimum maintained and optimally improved upon. What I mean by that is that the HPC must ensure that any such rate does not inadvertently entice providers to leave a network. Networks are valuable. They should be continued to be incented. And the default rate cannot be set so high as to incent folks to leave a network and get paid otherwise through an out-of-network reimbursement rate. For a variety of reasons, the normal insurance levers are not available in many instances of out-of-network services. For example, some out-of-network providers currently receive charges not controlled or regulated, and they can be set at any level. Incenting providers to further leave a network would cause significant increases in cost of the system and would seriously harm member access and member cost share.
Michael, can you try to wrap up?
Sure. This protection is particularly critical for incenting robust networks necessary for the insurance products that we all seek to design over the next generation of reform. We must stress that the cost impact of providers affects payers and the state's ability to meet the statewide benchmark. For some services, provider charges on average range between 3 to 5 times our in-network rate. We have seen some cases where the charge is as high as 100 times our in-network rate. When a health plan is forced to pay those levels to prevent balance billing, there's significant cost impact to the payer and the state. In conclusion, I want to stress those three key features again. As you can see, they're market-specific and they merit further detailed analysis. We appreciate the opportunity to continue that dialogue as the time passes, and we look forward to any questions that you might have. And thanks for listening.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you very much for your testimony. You indicated that you look out for patterns or of out-of-network usage. Do you use that information to assess your network adequacy for certain services? Like if you saw, you know, everything, there was a lot of out-of-network billing or around a certain kind of service, and that really stood out, do you use that to say, well, do we either have enough providers of that service, or do they have adequate access for partnerships?
It's a great question. The most illustrative example is when there are similar or better services already in network. So in many cases, a provider may be referring a patient to an alternative set of services outside of the network or the ACO system in which they're participating because they didn't know of an issue, a set of services that already exist. I would say that's the vast majority of the steerage corrections that occur. There are occasions, and they're rare, where we have either geographic access issues or network adequacy issues, and we correct those issues over time as well.
Like I have just a question, because I haven't experienced this, but when I go to a provider, they routinely ask me what my insurance coverage is, and I assume if they didn't, if that provider wasn't paid by that insurer, they wouldn't tell me that. Does that normally happen? Why do we have so much care, non-emergent care, I get that.
Commissioner Allen.
If you know, if somebody comes to you and they have Blue Cross Blue Shield or they have Tufts or something, that does not tell you anything, really, as a provider. I mean, as the individual provider, it might tell the system something, but about really which things are, because there are so many different Blue Cross Blue Shield policies, and there's so especially all the ERISA plans, you know, may have various providers. So you really, as somebody comes into your office, just speaking from past experience, but someone comes into your office and shows you an insurance card, it just, all it tells you is, it doesn't tell you enough specifics to tell you oh, I mean, even like I want to refer you to such and such a specialist, I may or may not know if that specialist is in the network. It's very difficult to tell. It's not as transparent as it could be. You might have a different answer.
No, no, I'd expand on it. I wouldn't have a different answer. I actually think that the tools of Chapter 224 around cost estimates are a really important aspect of making this work. And the carriers have now spent hundreds of millions of dollars of getting prepared to give exposure estimates to consumers in advance of treatment. There is a requirement on providers to also educate members, and at the very least, they could and should direct members to those tools. And so there's a little more education that could happen from the provider setting, because at root, patients are going to get their basic information from the provider they're seeing. And there's more work to be done there, frankly.
Dr. Kaplan? Mike, I have two questions for you. The first one is on the balance billing issue. I think some of what my concern is I think there are a couple different types. There's what you said, which is the vast majority, is there's a provider that's just not in network, and the patient inadvertently gets recommended to that provider, and that's just a mistake. We need to rectify that. The other part is sort of strategic, not being in the network. That is, the emergency department is in the network, but not the emergency surgeon, or the lab is in the network, but not the doctor who does the procedure. I guess it would be helpful for us to know how much of that goes on. That is, how much, how much sleazy out of network there is relative to just inadvertent mistakes that individuals make.
Right, as someone says. So it's difficult for us to triage those two separately because it gets to the mindset of the individuals at the time. I will say that the New York law does a really good job of addressing the different scenarios so that the member is actually given enough information prior to the time of services being received to make it at least somewhat of an informed choice. There's a mechanism in the New York law around consent, essentially a form that's used. And I'm by no means expert on the New York law. You know, we're proud to be a mass-only health plan. But it is certainly thoughtful on this topic because I think it's difficult. There are times when it can be inadvertent, but there are other times where it can be planned. And on one side, it's the patient knowledge, but there's also some patterns of conduct that are occurring with or without the patient's knowledge. And I think we have to sort of bring those out and discuss them more because I think we should treat them differently as we look at this problem.
My second question for you, I'm going to take you off topic for a minute.
Okay.
Your company sent a letter to the state saying that in response to the Gobay decision, it intends not to submit any information from self-employed employers to the state along any of a number of different margins, which, in addition to some of the very severely hindering the ability of the Commonwealth to conduct business about health care and understand health care. My question for you is your company willing to work with the Commonwealth to find a way to that you can submit the data, or is that a hard and fast position that the company will not advise?
So I want to go back before I go forward. The Gobay decision was issued on March 1st. We were the health plan that was actually the party of interest in the case. It was Liberty Mutual was the account. They took a lawsuit against the state of Vermont concerning their all-payer claims database. That decision, which was a 6-2 decision, was very clear that the state of Vermont was not able to collect, to mandate the collection of self-insured ERISA claim data. There are some that argue the holding goes even beyond that to all ERISA claim data, but the basic holding is self-insured ERISA plan data. We have communicated to our accounts that were they interested in having that information to continue to be submitted, we would do so. However, we felt that we, because of the state, are not allowed to submit that data pursuant to the case decision. I think we have a particularly studied view of it, having been through through the Supreme Court process and sort of aware of the parameters of it. That decision, I want to be clear, our letter pertained to the submission of self-insured ERISA plan data to the all-payer claims database. It does not, to this stage, include, nor have we made a final statement around submission of other data to the state, around issues like relative price, total medical expenses, annual premium data requests. There's any number of items that come in through CHIA or other entities for the purposes of data reporting. So I want to be very clear that this is distinct on its face to the all-payer claims database. I do think that there is an importance to that decision. There's an importance to that decision in terms of the choice that accounts make to choose to be self-insured. I can't speak for those accounts, but they make those decisions for a variety of reasons. And we have been one of the larger proponents of transparency and data reporting along this way. I think that, regrettably, there's not a lot that the state can do to overturn or otherwise redirect the conversation in light of the clear Supreme Court guidance. But if there are other ideas, we'd be happy to entertain them.
I think you should keep an open mind to whether there are other ideas before you foreclose helping out the common law with this important issue.
So I guess I would be always open to talk. You know, we as a company have shown that along the way. Kind of curious as to what that would look like. I'm not sure there's a lot of wiggle room in that case law. And so this is one where I want to be very clear that we will never walk away from a discussion. However, I do think it's important to look at that decision, to review it, and actually to get legal counsel on the decision, because it is a very clear decision.
And I would just note for the commissioners, we have been engaged with some of our fellow state agencies, CHIA, the Attorney General's Office, and trying to understand the impact of this decision on our data assets as a Commonwealth. And so I think worthy of its own in-depth conversation in trying to understand that. And we as a staff can hopefully keep that up.
And I would note that Blue Cross, for example, in the spirit of that dialogue, has communicated that to the director, has communicated that to the Health and Human Services Secretariat, and to CHIA, and invited further dialogue. I have not heard back yet from CHIA on that. And my letter is now 3 weeks old. I followed up with a call and an email, and I'd love to have that further discussion, but time's a waste.
As much as I'd love to continue us on this topic, the real business of the public comment, Mike, thank you.
Great.
Our next panel will be Claire McGowan of the Health by Advocates and Alyssa Vangel of Healthcare for All. In the spirit of the baseball season, our on-deck commenters will be Eric Linzer of Mass Health Plans, Rick Vail, Harvard Pilgrim, Susan Randall Johnson of Fallon Health, and Todd White Cross of Tufts Health Plan. Next week, Monday.
Thank you. I think we're sort of coordinated here, so I'm going to testify first. Good morning. I'm Claire McGorian. It's okay if you mispronounce it. It always gets, it's a unique name. Only my relatives have it. And I am Senior Staff Attorney at Health Law Advocates, and also the director of our commercial insurance appeals program and our mental health parity initiative. So what we did, we actually had some communication from staff here at the HBC because they knew that we might have some information on this topic of out-of-network surprise billing. And in fact, we do. Take my glasses off because I don't really need them. So the first question was, do we have any information or data on the extent to which consumers in Massachusetts are having problems with bills resulting from out-of-network care? And just the first disclaimer is Health Law Advocates is a nonprofit law firm. For any of you who don't know, we represent low-income consumers under 300% of poverty. We're not a data-gathering organization per se, but in our case, we have a database for our client cases, and that's where, you know, we can go to see what the trends have been. So this is very, I would say, very anecdotal, and probably not the full extent of even the information we have. And so I would be happy to go back and revisit my search techniques to see if there's some more examples. But within what we did, we identified about 14 cases from the last, year and a half. And a couple of those I'm just putting aside, they don't seem to quite fall into the category. But of those that we had, I'm going to identify a few trends that I saw. First among those, because I think it's really important, is ambulance, out-of-network ambulance bills. We definitely get those cases. I found three from that period. As I said, I think there may be some others that I missed in my search methods. Those are, you know, to my mind, really right up there with the worst, because people are in a situation, they absolutely have no knowledge, no ability to say, hey, don't pick me up, not only from a health standpoint, but from a timing standpoint. So it was a huge surprise to every one of these people that they would get this enormous bill. And these were covered services, so it wasn't an issue of like, oh, they didn't need an ambulance. It's definitely about the out-of-network. And, you know, basically what would happen is that, as you know, they would... their insurer would pay something, but it would be based on the, you know, allowed rate, and then there would be this enormous differential. And one case I knew the best, I remember it was about, I think the bill was about $1,400 or $1,600. It was actually, well, I can't remember what the purpose was, but it was an emergency call. And the insurer paid about $300. Then there was a deductible in the plan, so, you know, that had to be met. That was like $250. So basically, the person was left with this bill of, you know, $1,000+. And, you know, the way we resolved that was not through the appeal process for the insurer because, we didn't even really explore that. I think it may have been too late in the case at hand. But it really, I mean, it was clear that the provider was out of network. And it was more, to me, of a policy problem. And so for that individual, we ended up negotiating with the ambulance provider, who was extremely reasonable, basically waived the bill. So I don't think they're all like that. That was good. So we're definitely concerned about this ambulance situation, and I know that there have been some articles written about it over the years and problems in other states. So I think, you know, it's a little bit unique, I think, because I think there are a lot of, my sense is there are a lot of ambulance companies that don't participate in the networks. And again, I'm sure there's some happy medium between the amount they charge, I'd like to say there's a happy medium between the amount they charge and what the plans are paying so that there could be some meeting of the minds. Second trend that we had is lab tests. Which sounds kind of, lab test, that's not that big a deal, right? It's not surgery or an anesthesiologist speak, but it can add up, You need a lot of lab tests, and of course, and you tend to obviously rely on your doctor. I need these tests, you get the test. So what we've seen is people go to their in-network, outpatient provider, and have no knowledge of what lab they're sending it to or no real control over that, and then, come to find out they have to pay the bill, in full. And so some of those, in fact, we got one of those referred to us by a state rep, so it's reached that level. So I think that's another problem, and it seems like a really fixable problem to me in terms of communication and knowledge among the players, but I'll leave that part to you. The other, I guess, very broadly, to me, this is at the core of it, is the problem of misinformation or disinformation from the providers and from the plants, and both are sort of culpable. I heard what the doctor on the commission said, and I definitely can understand that there is this crazy array of plants, but we need something that will work better to hook up so they can find out, am I in this plan or not? I mean, it's just crazy that in this day and age we don't have that. And in fact, I think Chapter 224 required us to develop something like that, so I'm hoping that's happening. But that's a lot of what, I mean, the other cases we have are basically that, where sometimes the provider, but then the plan would sort of second them. The provider would say, oh, yes, I'm in the network. And then the patient would call the plan, and the plan would say, oh, yes, they're in the network. And then after the fact, they'd say, oh, no, they were actually not in the network because, they practice in two places maybe, and one place is in the network and the one isn't in the network. So, a lot of that, and I think those really, they may not be exactly, they're not emergency care, and they may not be exactly what the HPC was thinking of in bringing, raising this issue today, but it's a big part of it. It's just this lack of information or this misinformation, and then the person who gets hurt in that is the consumer. And so the last thing I just wanted to mention was, it was brought up about the cost estimate. legislation in Chapter 224, which I think is great, but and I personally haven't tried it, but we have discussed with others who are really looking at this, and my sense is that's not quite working as well as it should. So I'm sure the plans have poured money in and are trying to make it work, but I think that really needs to be improved, because that would be all would be part of this, and looking at, you know, when there's planning ahead, you can then look at what's going to happen and tell people what to expect. So as I say, I'd be happy to bring do another look and bring some more cases to the attention, but I think that's what I have for now.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Alyssa Vangeli. I'm a senior health policy manager at Healthcare for All. So we are, I guess we consider ourselves a sister agency of Healthline Advocates and work very closely with them. We do have a helpline that fields calls from individuals who are having difficulties or having questions accessing the healthcare system. And we do receive calls from individuals who have, who have received out-of-network bills, and we largely refer those cases over to Healthline Advocates. So as Claire mentioned, they've gone and done a search on their database, and I want to also mention that we are in the process of currently looking at this issue, so it's really wonderful timing that the HPC has taken it up, and we are also consulting with some of our other legal services partner organizations and other organizations who would be hearing from consumers on these issues. I think it is hard to, have comprehensive numbers about how many consumers are impacted in Massachusetts, but I will say that sort of over the coming weeks and months, we will continue to gather these stories, numbers, and continue to identify patterns and share that information with the Health Policy Commission. So along those lines, we've also been taking a look at the laws that have recently been passed in a number of states, and very much appreciate the Health Policy Commission's policy brief, which outlines a number of those laws. And we are also in the process of talking with individuals in other states about how those laws are working on the ground. The New York law has been in effect for about a year, and Connecticut passed the law recently. So I think we're still sort of finalizing what our specific recommendations would be in terms of improving protections for out-of-network billing. But in that process, we have identified a number of principles in terms of solutions that we think would be the most comprehensive in addressing out-of-network billing issues. I'm going to touch on those briefly. And they fall largely into the same categories that we identified. So the first is along increased transparency and disclosure. So we think that it's really critical that there be increased transparency and disclosure, both from insurers and providers in the state. And I think that some of this certainly can build upon the existing transparency requirements in 224. Those serve as a good basis for what's needed. But they also need some improvements. And so some examples are that provider directories, we know, are not often sort of updated and contain accurate information. So that's one area that we think deserves specific attention. The carrier websites could also have more information about, clear disclosures around whether or not our provider is out of network. The New York law has an interesting provision that requires hospitals to post on their website the insurance plans in which they're a participating provider, as well as contact information of physician groups that the hospital is contracted with for a number of services, and information about physicians employed by the hospital and the plans in which they participate. So we think that could be an interesting thing to look at. The Connecticut law also has a provision requiring that providers determine when a patient is insured prior to any scheduled admission or procedure, whether or not that the provider would be out of network for them. So that's sort of an at the point of service type of provision. We don't know yet how that's working on the ground, but definitely interested to see if that is working. The second major category is around prohibitions on balance billing and holding consumers harmless. So we think this is a really critical element in terms of making sure that consumers are not harmed, when they don't have any control over accessing an out-of-network provider or when it's a surprise bill. And both New York and Connecticut have strong provisions around this. New York prohibits balance billing in emergency situations and also in other situations as long as the benefit or the claim is assigned to the insurer, which makes sense. And sort of the third category is around establishing a well-defined process for determining payment. We think this is also a critical component in terms of making sure that there is sort of a reasonable payment established, but also in terms of removing the consumer from that negotiation from the provider and the payer. So there are a number of ways to, you know, go about doing this, as Kate mentioned. New York leaves it a little bit open in that they that the insurers must be providers at a reasonable payment amount and must disclose that amount. And then if the provider is not satisfied with that amount, there's this option of this independent dispute resolution process, which we think is an interesting approach. Or Connecticut has a number of sort of set ways to calculate how that other provider reimbursement would work. So I think we're still, you know, looking at those options and determining sort of which we think is the best. We definitely think that there needs to be a well-defined way to determine the payment amount. And then lastly, I'll just say that we think that there needs to be some strong provisions around notifying consumers of these provisions and these rights, and that has to come from both insurers and providers. As Mike mentioned, it can come in the form of sort of benefits materials, explanation of benefits forms, and sort of at any point that the consumer would come in contact with the healthcare system. So that's what we have for now. We will be, I think, following up with more detailed written remarks, especially as we're gathering more information. But that we should be
questions for panelists.
Claire, just a quick question. I found your examples really helpful. Out-of-network ambulance bills seem to me to be really complicated, and maybe this is also a topic for the next panel to briefly address, because you're going through a kind of third-party, out-of-network triage person when you dial 911. So the person who answers the 911 call has no way of ever knowing whether the ambulance service they're sending is in or out of your network, and neither would you until they arrive. So, I mean, it goes back to Mike's point, I think, about balance billing prohibitions that we might propose. But I wonder if you could just talk a little bit more about how we might solve that problem, or I would ask the payers on the next panel to do the same.
How do you solve it? I don't know. I have personal encounter.
David wants us to ask the ambulance providers, which is also a good
yes.
Point.
Are they here?
I want to know who we should ask. I'm actually serious. Which provider should we be asking questions?
I think in this instance, certainly it's the ambulance, but it's also, for me, the payer's relationship. And if you go back to our saying, we want more information from the payers and the providers to the patient. How do you control that when you're not the physician ordering the lab? I mean, that I get. But in the middle of, you know, at 3 in the morning, when you dial 911, you're kind of toast.
Right. I mean, as I've said to people, I had my own unfortunate encounter with this when my partner was injured. It was like in the middle of the night. And had to call 911, and we have excellent insurance. I won't be me sure, but it's a big one. But still, because I knew about this problem, I thought, you know, it wasn't my first thought. Believe me, I was like, oh my God, this happened. This is horrible. But and they were great ambulance service. They're really nice. We live in Medford. But you know, I thought, oh God, maybe we're gonna get that bill later. You know, like after all this, you know, the emergency. Anyway, everything went well, and the bill was covered. But actually, that speaks to the fact that perhaps it is a very large insurer that they have a larger network of ambulances. Because we went through 911, you know, I guess it's in Medford. I don't know where it comes from. But and I think this ambulance company is like the Medford's own, you know, the one that Medford uses. So that was good news for us. But how do you deal with that? I mean, I think really the networks just have to be bigger, or there has to be a meeting of the minds about some kind of compromise price. I mean, I'm not really the policy person, although obviously I do that as part of my job, but, you know, we did speak with the director of the ambulance company and got them to waive it. And, you know, full disclosure, this fellow, you know, I don't know if he wants me to name his company, but he's a great guy, and I'll ask him if he'd be interested in testifying. But he knows health law advocates, and he's, you know, years ago he knew one of our colleagues and came to speak to us about, you know, ambulances and bills, because we've always had issues with ambulance bills. It's a problem, not just the network problem. But he, you know, I mean, the rate that was being paid, the allowable rate, and the rate that he was charging was, I would say, it was 5 or 6 time differential. And, you know, is his company gouging? Is the insurer, like, being too tight about it? You know, I'm not in a position to say what it's worth, but there's got to be something in between. I mean, and I don't quite know if that's what they're paying. I actually don't know how insurers are getting any ambulance companies in their networks, because this guy's very busy. They're a pretty big ambulance company. And they just don't need to do it, you know? And he's, when it comes down to it, I think he is the kind of person who will waive the bill, you know, because a lot of things do get covered. So I think it's just too, yeah, that's, those are my thoughts. But it's a challenging system, but I think some other states actually have taken an approach, and we can certainly get that too.
Any other questions? Okay, if not, thank you. We'll bring up Eric Linzer, Rick Vale, Susan Randall Johnson, and Todd Whitefrost, and on deck will be Bonnie Gilbert from the Greater Boston Area.
Good morning, Chairman Cohen, members of the commission. For the record, my name is Eric Linzer. I'm with the Massachusetts Association of Health Plans. With me today is Todd Whitecross from Tufts Health Plan, Susan Randall Johnson from Fallon Health, and Rick Vale from Harvard Pilgrim. These are folks that are either involved with the provider contracting process or the member appeals process. I thought what we would do today is, on behalf of our members, we'll provide some context, and Todd, Susan, and Rick are certainly here to answer any questions that the commission may have. With respect to the issue of out-of-network billing practices, we would certainly concur with many of the issues that Mike had raised earlier about the challenges that plans face and what the potential impact is for both employers and consumers in relation to ensuring appropriate care, but also the impact it has on costs, and most specifically, the cost benchmark. With that, I'd like to focus our comments on the questions that the staff had provided to provide a little bit of context globally around what how our members typically handle these issues. We certainly appreciate the fact that this does create some issues for consumers, and I think in most instances, plans will typically keep the member out of the middle, recognizing that in certain instances that we've heard today, whether it's among ERAP providers or ambulance providers, the member just may not have the opportunity or know about it going into a particular service. That said, I think the question that one of the issues that we've heard from the staff is the frequency with which this occurs with different providers. I think obviously it depends on the provider type. It can certainly range as it relates to the ERAP providers. Typically, a couple of cases a month may come across each plan. It would be certainly more frequent in the instance of out-of-network ambulance billing practices. And one area that we're starting to hear more about, and Claire had raised it, concerns the issue of out-of-network laboratories. And that seems to be a much more daily occurrence, or more regular occurrence than the issue around ERAP. But I think to think about these terms, these types of providers, you need to sort of bucket them into two separate areas.
Eric, could you just tell us what ERAP is?
Sure, that's the it's emergency radiologist, anesthesiologist, and
pathologist.
It's always one you forget. So with that, I would bucket ERAP and ambulances sort of into the same categories. I mean, these are providers that occur when the member's probably at his or her most vulnerable. They may not know that the provider is out of network, and more often than not, the plans aren't going to know about it until one of two things happens. Either the member, we receive a claim and it appears that the service has been done on an out of network basis. We may not know the context about it. Unfortunately, we may have to deny the claim, and then the conversation starts with the member and with the provider. And then in other instances, it may be that the member has received a bill from the provider, similar to the ambulance issue that was just talked about, and the issue gets presented to the plans. In the case of out-of-network laboratory services, I think to a certain degree, there seems to be a bit of a communication and coordination issue with certain providers. I think there may be some physician groups and outpatient services that are accustomed to using certain labs that may not be part of a health plan's network. When we become aware of this, one of two things happens. Either we'll work with that provider to educate them on which labs are in the network versus which ones are out of the network, versus trying to contract with those out-of-network laboratory labs in order to be able to address some of these issues. That said, And the issue around communication, I think, is one that certainly is a challenge for plants. As I mentioned, plants don't typically know when these types of services occur until really notified about it. But at the same time, I think to the question about disclosure to the member, information to the member, our plans typically provide a good bit of information on how to resolve these issues. I understand that the brief talks about the need for standardized way for communicating this information. That said, I think when you look at both the plan's EOCs, and I have one with me today, and mind you, it's 118 pages long, and I'm not sure how many members actually go through it. But that said, information is there as required by statutory and regulatory requirements. In addition to that, we do provide that information as part of any kind of EOB or any kind of member appeal, so that the member has information, not just who to contact at the health plan from a member service standpoint, but we also include information on contacting Healthcare for All, so that folks know that there are opportunities for them to raise these issues. So I think from that standpoint, there is communication that goes with the member. Part of the question is, how much is the member really taking a look at this type of information? Remember, the EOC, the EOB that the member gets after service, it was typically a couple of pages long, and there's some requirements around how much regulatory information we have to include in there, and certain disclosures and things like that that could certainly create the unintended consequence of a member opening the mail, looking at it, shrugging the shoulders, and just throwing it in the trash. So with regard to some of the challenges that the plans face, a lot of the discussion that we hear really is about the rate. And I understand the question about can there be a meeting of the minds between plans and certain providers? I think as folks will attest from our membership, we do everything we can to try and have a very broad and extensive network. The challenge becomes with certain providers who, for whatever reason, choose not to participate in health plan networks, in large part because they're vital providers, and they need to, and they recognize that they're going to see patients and our members regardless, that there is no incentive for them to enter into a network contract if they're able to charge or bill for excessive rates that in some instances can be 3, 4, or even 8 or 9 times what Medicare charges. And we do have examples both from some out-of-network lab bills that are in excess of 10 times what Medicare typically pays. Examples from the ambulance discussion I know some of you have been familiar with over the last 4 or 5 years, in which we're talking about rates of in excess of 3, 4, or 5 times what Medicare charges. And again, in the instance of trying to keep costs under control, plans will contract at a reasonable rate, but certainly rates that exceed 4 or 5 times what Medicare pays, we think is unreasonable. With that, the only only other piece that we would touch on is the issue around how to address these issues. And we've heard from the first two panelists a couple of different approaches, and I think we would generally concur with two large buckets. One certainly is the issue for greater transparency for providers. There's a number of provisions in the New York law that should be made available, and information should be made available to the member or patient in advance of services, and some work that should be done on the part of providers to ensure that the folks that they're referring to are in fact in the network, and if they're not, then to at least make the member aware so that they're able to make an informed decision. I think one of the, what we may hear from some providers is that they may not know who is or isn't in the network, but I think it's typically, plan paper provider directories may be outdated. I think everybody pretty much goes online and you can kind of look up who's in and who's not in the network, and if not, certainly the plan's provider relations departments are available to have conversations with individual providers. The issue around setting an out-of-network default rate is one that has certainly been discussed as it relates to ambulance providers, and I think folks are aware and may be aware of some of the discussions around what's been proposed in the past between the difference of the lesser of either the plan's usual and customary or 300% of Medicare. I think one of the challenges, and Mike had touched upon this earlier, is setting what a reasonable rate is, because I think the concern would be ensuring that a rate that is too high or potentially excessive could have the impact of And while maybe bringing some providers down, it could have the effect of lower cost providers, those paid below whatever that default is, to drop out of the network. And I think, as the brief points out, the networks are important components in terms of ensuring high quality, cost effective care to Massachusetts members and employers. So, with that as context, we're certainly happy to answer any questions. And again, we appreciate the high priority that the Commission and the staff have placed on this issue.
Comments, questions by the Commission?
Just a question on the ambulance case. And, you know, we're pretty familiar with that. But you know, Claire cited the previous example of an ambulance company that was charging 4 or 5 times what the contracted. Who pays that 4 or 5 times rate? If they're not in a network, how are they getting paid?
So, you know, I'll defer to some of the folks on the panel, but I think typically, Rick, the challenge becomes this, that if the goal is to keep the member out of the middle and the service has already occurred,
yep,
where's the incentive for the provider to then decide to come in with a lower rate? So there may be some conversations that go on between the plan and the provider as to, can we really get this rate knocked down a good bit to be something that's closer to more reasonable? I think, unfortunately, the challenge is, you know, if we want to ensure that the member doesn't get harmed in this instance, it's difficult to encourage the provider to come to the table and have conversations after the service has been provided. So, you know, what essentially would happen is the plan may have to end up paying the full rate, or there may be some negotiation that lowers it a bit. But I think where we start from is the example of the rates that come, the exorbitant rate that may come in.
Right.
What happens from there? There may be some negotiation, but there's not a whole lot of leverage on the part of the plan.
So I'm going to get more specific. So I want to ask for specific proper names, as in X ambulance company or Y hospital over there. I don't understand why we're protecting doing this, and I want to get a sense of the problem. So is it sort of largely ambulance? Is it largely an ambulance thing? You mentioned ERAPs. Is it some particular institutions? Why don't we just introduce the names so that we can understand what's going on?
Yeah, David, I think it obviously varies.
would you like to bring your chair up?
I'll add my voice. I'll sit over here. I can give you a breakdown from the ERAP providers as
right
to where the costs
absolutely
lie,
yep,
and right then some examples of providers that we
proceed in this fashion.
Sure. Right. You know, these are folks who should be invited to the dialogue.
Yeah.
Ambulance is certainly a very large element. Let me give you a breakdown of some cost just for Blue Cross for this out-of-network issue, if I can find the right page. So I will say that, you know, before I get to this, the big issue is when we are mandated to pay, right? So in the ambulance scenario, we are mandated to pay charges by federal and state law. Those charges end up being, at a minimum, you know, 300 to 400% of what would be charged in an in-network scenario, and sometimes as much as 10 times as much. We have an in-network rate. We have had some success in attracting new ambulance providers to that in-network participation, even despite the difference between charges and the in-network rate, mainly because we've made it difficult for ambulance companies to collect the payment. We pay the member, and we make the ambulance company get the money from the member and hold the member completely harmless, but that administrative hurdle has had the effect of incenting folks to join our network. It's the only tool we have, given the frank issue of payment issues. There remain ambulance companies that continue to not want to be in the Blue Cross network. They include, historically, some companies in the North Shore. Trinity is a name that has been quite vexing. There are other issues, other ones like that. We're happy to have that conversation. I know that that's an issue that has come up before. In terms of the ERAP providers from Blue Cross, the major spend is in the areas of the ambulance is the biggest issue, right? From the ERAP providers, anesthesia and ER physicians is relatively small money. Radiology is more, and pathology is a significant expense. Pathology continues to be, at least for Blue Cross, and maybe distinct for each carrier, I don't know. But the pathology spend is over $2 million in terms of volume for out-of-network spend. So ambulance and pathology, and then radiology is how I would rank them.
Todd, you wanted to ask?
Yes, Rick.
Oh, Rick. I'm sorry.
Rick. I think our list will compare for the most part. You know, if we went down the line, I think our provider list will compare comparably to a certain degree, particularly with providers such as the ambulance companies. Trinity is an excellent example. When they declare a position, they'll do that across the board with all plans. You know, I have some personal history directly with Trinity where we continue to go back to the table to have discussions to try to re-energize that with their success. I'm not sure, Todd, if you have the same experience with Trinity or not. We have, you know, pathology is definitely a growing concern in our program, and it seems more of the high-end pathology, not just your routine. But we do see anesthesiologists being continuing to be concerned, and that's over the last, you know, say, you know, 10 years or so. There's certain groups that will just choose not to, and anesthesiologists, from my perspective, are really difficult. It's much like emergency medicine, you know, a doctor, you know, you're from HVMA, I believe, you know, refers to a specialist that's in network to have a knee surgery, members on the table, sees the anesthesiologist, and guess what? That facility contracts with these groups, the anesthesiologist group, to provide those services to the possible physician. I'm sorry, the member has no way to identify, you know, who those groups are. Those have been challenging, and every year we've got to hit list targeted providers that we're looking to re-engage on discussion. You know, just, I'm going to underscore comments from before. You know, we are talking, whether it's ambulance or any other type of provider, about setting some kind of appropriate, you know, rate of pay. We've got to really be careful not to put ourselves, and that's not just us as a plan, but in a position where we're actually driving up cost. You know, the integrity of our networks is so greatly important. So, you know, we don't want to see more providers, you know, opting out of our network to go to a higher rate of pay or something that's more administratively simple and get paid something that's comparable. So, not sure if others have
questions. I don't understand the economics of that statement. I'm sorry for monopolizing. If you say that they're currently charging 10 times Medicare, and if it were limited to 2 times Medicare, more would choose to go out of network, presumably they could go out of network now and charge 2 times Medicare. So why would limiting it to 2 times Medicare be more difficult to go out of network?
You know, I think we all human natures to focus on the most extreme examples. You know, lab to, I want to be careful, I don't think everybody's charged 10 times. Those are the ones we read about and care about.
Yeah.
So I do want to be careful on that. But we do have, you know, our job is not to sign bad contracts, you know, to make sure we're for all of our members, all of our accounts.
But there's no reason that any particular limit would impact them in any way that they couldn't have otherwise done on their own.
Well, while that's true, the majority, I think, in many of these categories, with potential exception of ambulance, are contracted in many of the networks. And so you have 60-70% of ER physicians, pathologists, contracted at a rate that's, call it Medicare, and then a smaller portion that's charging excessive Medicare. That's how it would end up in grant, because you would then wave the flag in front of all the ones who are contracted today just to go and get that default rate. Whereas today, for whatever reason, they've decided to contract, whether they're less interested in having the engagement with the member, whether they're going to threaten to take them to collections, or whatever choice they've made to become contracted, a default rate may make that easier for the ones who are
First of all, let me clarify that I don't work for Harvard Vanguard anymore. I haven't for 4 years. So
I'll
be sure you understand. I don't work for an employer, for a healthcare provider. We need to find a solution here. And I'm just this is a sort of a theoretical question, but are there services where they shouldn't be in a network because for whatever reason, either that the patient has no control over how they access those services, or it's a unique service that really you can only get in certain places, or it's an emergency like an ambulance or something. And if that would be the case, I mean, if that's the case, then it seems like maybe the default idea might work or might be the solution, but it sounds, I hear some of the problems with that. So what solution would you propose? Because it feels like there are situations where really people have no control and will be, quote, out of network. And then even if it's resolved, it's a whole lot of work for everybody, for the patient, for the plan, you know, to resolve it. And that's a cost to the system as well.
You know, speaking on behalf of Harvard Code, we would applaud efforts to have some kind of default payment. It's where that is set.
Okay.
You know, so that's the piece that I'm just, you know, underscoring. Is where, what level of reimbursement would be appropriate to say, okay, here's our default. I don't think any of us are looking to drive up overall healthcare costs as a result of policy decisions. So that's my
other
thoughts.
I would agree with that. I think, again, the points that have been made by Mike earlier and Eric around disclosure of this on the provider side, I think would be helpful. And I would not agree with this notion that we should have some set of services that wouldn't be contracted. We would want a contract in a perfect world with every set of services. I think that's good for everyone. It decreases the number of times that a member is going to be stuck chasing their tail and chasing us and getting caught between us and the provider.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Because from a member perspective, their ability to know what the network is and look it up online is so important. And they also have, in many of these cases, a cost share. So when they have a lower cost share because there's a better rate, it helps the members.
The other piece to keep in mind about carving out certain providers, it does get into then the potential for network adequacy issues, and I think that would run afoul of some of the standards that the Division of Insurance would expect, and likewise some federal requirements in that area.
Ron?
Do you know how New York and Connecticut specifically addressed the ambulance issue in their law?
I mean, we would have to double check with our national counterparts on that, Ron. I think ambulances would be, I think that part of the what's covered is part of both the New York and Connecticut laws. And I think, you know, there are certain pluses and minuses both to how those two states handled it. I mean, in the instance of Connecticut, specifically as it relates to the out-of-network rate, I think there was, you know, there's some combination of Medicare or the plan's in-network rate. Again, to the points that Todd and Rick had raised, I think you really need to take a good look at that about as to how that may affect encouraging providers who aren't in the network to come into the network. As it relates to New York and the sort of dispute resolution, independent review process, it's something that I think we want to sort of we want to think about how that plays in the marketplace. The disclosure pieces, though, I think would be an important place to start. Because if you think about it, you know, while there's been an awful lot of conversation about transparency in the plan's websites, I think, you know, one piece that's been missing from the conversation around transparency has been the requirement on providers to make this information available before a member or patient seeks services. And while there has been the Department of Public Health, and again, 2013 or 14, had put out a notice outlining what the requirements were for providers. If you look at what the Pioneer Institute has done over the last couple of years, it's really been sort of substandard the way the provider communities provide information to patients and our members.
Can I come to the pathologist for a second? So you have hospitals where if a person shows up in the emergency department, the emergency services are covered, but the pathologist is not in network, the staff pathologist at that hospital is not in network. Can you give us examples? I presume this is a conscious decision of the hospital to not have the pathologists. Can you give us examples?
I don't think they're always employed by the hospital. They're typically services that they contract out.
But the hospital knows that they're not going to be covered. So the hospitals are choosing to do business in a way that exposes the member to more.
Our experience hasn't been as much pathology with facilities, hospitals. It's been anesthesiologists from our data, our perspective. And I can give you examples of that.
But so that's the same situation.
Same situation. They're contracting.
So can you give us examples? Like names?
David's taking names today.
Why don't, I'm not sure why it should be private information that here is a hospital that has chosen.
Cape Cod Hospital is an excellent example from my perspective.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say from my perspective, rather than list off the two examples that I can think of, if you really want that information, if you make a request, then
okay,
we can get that to you.
They may vary by plan as well.
I'm happy to know that.
Eric? What would be really interesting, Eric, is for you to list on your website not only the people who are out of network, but what percent of Medicare they charge. So, I mean, that would really drive consumer behavior. If I saw X was out of network, but it was only 2 times Medicare, and that was really important that I have that particular person, as opposed to 10 lines. That would be really interesting data.
But I would say in the case of emergent services, we are going to your local hospital, I think that data could stand to just increase the charges that their local hospital would draw. But really, for the most part, the things that are referred or non-emergent services, I think transparency helps and it makes the informed decisions on the part of members easier. In these cases, I think it would more likely serve the benefit of providers who are lower on the egregious standard to increase the rates for that.
Rick, and then I'm going to ask us.
Okay, and it just seems to be some consensus from what I hear from the insurers about at least dealing with the ambulance, out-of-provider ambulances is a process to set some kind of a default rate that isn't excessive, like what you're saying there. Do you have a specific, where I assume the legislature to pass something to this process?
So a couple of weeks from now, if there's an amendment filed to this effect, I would imagine there'd probably be some conversations about, among folks on whether or not it's a good amendment or a bad amendment. I think the piece to keep in mind here is that we've been dealing with this issue since 2010, 2011. And as folks may recall, back in October 2010, the former governor had put forth a proposal that really accomplished the goals that if folks really felt that this was an important thing to keep the member out of the middle, it would solve the problem. And essentially it had 3 components. One, it prohibited balance billing. Second, it established an out-of-network default rate at the lesser of the plan's usual and customary, or 300% of Medicare. And I can't believe I'm going blank on this. Default rate out of network, and I'm blanking on this, right? I'm embarrassed. I can't believe I'm blanking on this. It's been enough letters that we've written on this issue. We'll probably write another letter on this issue. I think where we stand is what the former governor put forth was a reasonable approach. It accomplished the goals. It prohibited direct payment to the member. So what it did was it said, we're not going to put the member in the middle. The member's not going to get a bill from the provider. And we're going to provide a reasonable rate of reimbursement. And I think folks felt that that was a reasonable approach at that time. Now, there's been a number of other proposals that have come forth around dispute resolution and giving the Secretary of Health and Human Services some responsibilities, although I'm sure she's got plenty to do. But again, I think going back to 2010, that was a reasonable alternative that for whatever reason the ambulance companies have just not seen fit to think that that's acceptable.
Eric and panel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Before I ask Bonnie to come up out of my deep sense of fairness, if there's someone from Trinity who would like to respond, we'll certainly allow them.
And Commissioner Cohen, but if I might say, we have reached out staff has reached out to providers. We've reached out to MHA. They were unable to be here today. I think we'll pass around some written comments, and we'll continue to do some follow-up to get some more specific details. And we're really trying to understand the sort of dynamics of hospital outsourcing of those services, because that is very commonplace. To Commissioner Cartlow's question, we've also reached out to Mass Medical Society to try to get at some of those ERAP provider specialist types of questions, so we'll continue to do that outreach.
Great, thank you. I thought I was trying to help.
Lonnie.
Good morning, Commissioners, and committee, and thank you so much for having me. My name is Bonnie Gilbert. I'm with Temple Sinai, and I'm a member of GBIO, Greater Boston Interface Organization, and a member of the healthcare committee. And I think I've met actually with some of you here, primarily, we have met with some people here, primarily around the price variation issue, which we tend to see more as an underpay and overpay issue. And along a similar vein, we see this also as an affordability and overpayment issue for the consumer. And that is really our reason for being here today, is to keep the focus on the insured, on the consumer, on the patient. And for myself, I became involved in this issue because last year on out-of-pocket medical expenses, premiums, co-pays, high deductibles, and things that are simply not covered at all, my family of five, middle-class family, spends close to $25,000, and there's no life-threatening illness involved. So that made me come to the table. So with that in mind, and with today's discussion, our concerns primarily go to mental health care costs, because that is a big chunk of what I ended up paying for, what we pay for every year. And so we have two sort of requests, two sort of foci. One would be the collection of data on what insurers are actually spending on outpatient, out-of-network mental health service providers. And two, what is being done, or is there any look at the fact that these dollars that are being spent on out-of-network care providers are not going to my maximum dollar out-of-pocket expense? So if my contract is $6,000, or if the law is $13,000, that $10,000, $11,000 that is beyond customary and reasonable services is not being applied to the maximum out-of-pocket dollars. And that's how we end up with these exorbitant spendings by patients. And these are for things that you cannot get in network. Child care, child therapists, child psychiatrists are not in network. So it is not, I find it fascinating with all of the discussion around ERAP and how you don't have a choice because of the emergency of the situation. When your child needs therapy, it's basically the same. So that is the issues that we would like to bring forward today.
Thank you. Questions?
Someone raised that earlier as a network adequacy issue.
Right, and
what does it mean to say you have a network of child psychiatrists if there are none that actually accept your rating?
Exactly, and I was thinking of exactly that when that question.
But those are, I agree, those are separate issues. The network adequacy issue is conceptually important, but it's also a separate issue from the emergency services. Sometimes they blend together in the sense that the emergency service is not physically taking place.
Right. It's an underlying similarity. And yet it's all being viewed from the emergency side and not from ongoing services that are excluded for a number of different services.
All right.
Thank you very much.
And has anyone else signed up? I don't have anyone.
Okay. And anyone else seeking to provide comment? If not, we'll close the public comment session. Thank you very much. A very enlightening discussion, and I appreciate everybody who participated. We had planned on a discussion of preliminary findings from our oral health brief, but I think given the time and we went a little late, I think we're going to put that on hold, David. So unless there's any other...
I just want to say we've been
definitely need to come back to it. And we,
yes.
It's like we're putting the head back on the body for mental health. Maybe I'll have to put the teeth back on. Sorry.
Would it be worthwhile to have a separate panel with the providers? And do it on this, obviously, sorry, on this issue.
Sure.
Yeah.
We can do that.
It doesn't have to be an entire session, but as part of either another combined meeting or one of the two committee meetings where people could come as they wish.
Especially now that we have names.
Now that we have
names. We'll have statements in their request.
Those names are going to be in the Globe tomorrow.
Veronica, I look like a mild man. Here's a TV in an ambulance.
Do I have a motion to adjourn? You all.
Yeah. Nellie, can we stop this?
I know.
I don't want to mess it up.